Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Michael Goldfarb.
It's Here and Now.
A series of car bombs went off almost simultaneously today in the southern Iraqi city of Basra. The suicide attacks happened during rush hour. More than 60 people were killed. The governor of Basra said al-Qaeda may have played a role in the well-coordinated attacks in Iraq's second-largest city. Dominic D'Angelo is with the Coalition Provisional Authority in Basra. I spoke with him earlier today and asked him about the attacks.
This morning in Basra, we had three suicide car bomb attacks on three police stations. That was followed about an hour later by two attacks on the Regional Police Training Academy, which is based in the town of Azubaya, a few miles southwest of Basra. The total number of casualties so far that we're aware of is 68 dead and at least 100 people injured. The vast majority of the people who were killed were civilians. They weren't Iraqi police, although some Iraqi police were injured and others had been killed. The deaths include a number of children who were in buses taking them to school when the car bombs exploded in the different locations.
Now, attacks on police stations and on police recruitment centers are not unusual in Iraq. In fact, they've been these attacks have been increasing. This is the first attack of this nature in Basra, is it not?
Yes, it is. And it's also probably the most serious terrorist attack that's taken place in the south since the conflict. And I suppose it's noteworthy precisely because it's targeting Iraqi police. As you know, there's been some comment in the media in recent days about the performance of both the Iraqi police and the Iraqi Civil Defense Corps. And the judge's own press conference earlier today pointed out the fact that, that generally Basra has been pretty safe, has been pretty quiet, and the police are doing a good job. And it just seemed to us that the attempt by terrorists to target Iraqi police is precisely because they are doing a good job.
How secure were the police stations? In places like Kirkuk and Baghdad and Mosul, you find sizable defenses outside police stations. Was there easier access to these police stations in Basra?
Normal practice here in Basra, at least, is to have concrete blocks available outside all the police stations with no parking allowed, as well as having police officers on duty with armaments, both at ground level and usually up on the roof.
So then these bombs presumably didn't breach those defenses and were always going to explode into the street where it was going to kill civilians more likely than police?
Yeah. There was no way in which these attacks were going to take place and that they were not going to harm Iraqi civilians. And that leads you to think that actually these are people who are simply determined to strike at any sort of normalization of life here in Iraq, simply in order to achieve some sort of political goal.
Who do you suspect of carrying this attack out?
Well, I can't speculate on who's carried it out, although there is a person in custody after the attempt at Azubaya. A person was caught running away from the scene.
Is he Iraqi?
Being questioned. I don't know. I mean, what I can say is the governor's speculation today was that this was obviously well organized and well planned and probably had not been planned just a few days ago, but probably several weeks ago. The cars were all similar in terms of model. The sorts of explosive power seems to have been similar in each case. Now, the governor has mentioned al-Qaeda as a possible source. He's also mentioned al-Zarqawi, who, as you know, there is a hunt for in Iraq at the moment, as possibly a mastermind behind it. And he also mentioned the fact that and some people have gone from Basra up towards Fallujah to join in the fighting up there, and he suggested that some of them may have been told to come back down here and cause trouble in Basra.
Dominic D'Angelo, I want to thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dominic D'Angelo is Director of Communications for the Coalition Provisional Authority South. He spoke to us on a line from Basra.
A double suicide bombing in the Saudi capital of Riyadh today killed at least 9 people. 2 car bombs went off in front of the National Police Headquarters. Al-Qaeda is believed to be behind the attack. Last month, a message said to be from the group appeared on the Internet, threatening to attack Saudi police in their homes and offices. Well, joining us from Riyadh is Mohammed Al-Ghamdi, Bureau Chief of the Saudi Gazette. Welcome, Mohammed.
Thank you.
First of all, could you hear the blast from where you are, and how is it, you know, how was it heard in the city?
My office is about 5 to 6 kilometers away from the blast, and I heard it. It was a large blast indeed, and a few minutes afterwards, I myself drove to the scene of the blast.
And what did you see?
I saw a huge building, the old headquarters of the public security, and the entire front of the building was badly devastated, and so were all the buildings near it. It was in the blast took place in a crowded downtown part of Riyadh. Mm.
Has anyone claimed responsibility, or has the government assigned responsibility?
The terrorists who operate within the kingdom, I think, are responsible. And I think even the suicide bomber was identified identified by the police. Of course, he died in the blast.
As a Saudi?
Most probably, yes. They are local terrorists.
Yeah. Well, let's put this in some context. The American embassy, as you well know, last week ordered all non-essential employees and family members out of Saudi Arabia because of fears of a terror attack. And there have been other incidents in recent days. Can you tell us about them?
Well, the security forces have been succeeding in catching explosive-laden trucks operated by these terrorists and intended to be used for terrorist purposes.
What?
Now, go ahead.
What is the purpose? Is it assumed that the targets of these attacks is the House of Saud? What is the point?
No, the point ought to be made clear, I think, because this today's blast also explains things better. In the past, these terrorists wanted to target Westerners, more likely Americans, because of their Al-Qaeda-linked ideas of terror, basically. Mm. Now they are targeting those who are at war with them. Those at war with these terrorists are the government and the people of Saudi Arabia. So I think they are being cornered and squeezed out of their positions, and now they are targeting the security forces themselves.
But
this is a first. This is a first in their terror campaign. Mm.
And again, you interpret this as meaning that they're cornered and they're attacking essentially their countrymen.
Absolutely, they are being cornered, and the government is scoring very high on cornering them and capturing them and hopefully in the long run eradicating them. Mm-hmm. So they are hitting everywhere.
Mr. Al-Ghamdi, what is the feeling now? Are Saudis bracing for more attacks? Have there been more alerts?
I was in the middle of the site immediately after the blast, and I met with a lot of Saudis and also a lot of expats. But the Saudis are very angry at the terrorists. They are very spontaneously with the government and with the police forces, and they don't like what they see because Riyadh is like a major metropolitan city in America or the West. We don't like this. This is nasty.
Any sense that there might be more attacks? I mean, obviously you can't know, but have there been government warnings or?
No, there are no government warnings, but you could feel that until they are totally eradicated, they will continue to cause harm. Mm.
Mohammed Al-Ghamdi, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mohammed Al-Ghamdi, Riyadh Bureau Chief for the Saudi Gazette, speaking of today's car bombings in Riyadh.
Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld acknowledged yesterday that Pentagon officials have drawn up contingency plans to send fresh U.S. troops to Iraq. Rumsfeld also held out the possibility that the Bush administration was prepared to increase the size of the American force in that country, if U.S. military commanders requested it. Currently, there are 135,000 American soldiers in Iraq. Joining us on the line is Major Charles Heyman, senior defense analyst for the Jane's Consultancy Group in Britain. Hello, Major Heyman.
Hello.
Why has the Pentagon done this at this time?
Well, it's quite obvious that the force levels on the ground in Iraq are nowhere near enough to control what is a situation that is probably worsening by the day.
What effect does the withdrawal of forces from Spain, Honduras, and the Dominican Republic, effect does that have on coalition operations?
The truth at the end of the day, of course, is it doesn't have a major effect on coalition operations. We're talking about very small numbers here. It does have a political effect, and it does have a morale effect. There's no doubt about that.
Now, 135,000, I think to most listeners, will sound like a considerable number of troops. When you face this kind of insurgency that the U.S., and let's call it the U.S. because the overwhelming number of troops are supplied by the U.S., as a military expert, what do you think is a reasonable number of soldiers to face down this kind of insurgency?
Well, the problem here is, of course, you need a raft of different security troops. You need soldiers armed and trained reasonably conventionally. But you also need paramilitary troops, and you need lots and lots of police. All three come together to control the security situation on the ground. Now, unfortunately, the Iraqi police and the Iraqi Civil Defense Corps are not going to be up to the task in large numbers for some considerable time to come, and it may even be years. You're probably looking at around about 500,000 security force-type troops to control a country the size of Iraq.
When you say 500,000, that is an astonishing number, and it's a political number as well. I imagine that if the Bush administration had said, you know, to police the country after the overthrow of the regime, we may need up to 500,000 men, not even Republicans in Congress would have endorsed that.
No one would have endorsed anything like that. And this is an unfortunate result of the military operation that we as a coalition undertook. I mean, if you actually look at numbers, even 500,000 may be not enough to ensure the right environment for the political solution that we're actually seeking at the end of the day.
When you say 500,000, you're not talking about Americans sending 500,000 soldiers. What you're talking about is a total security presence of American forces
and local paramilitaries and police as well. But you have to look at a campaign like this in the overall context of security and not just military presence.
Are there any reports in Britain that the British government has been asked by the Bush administration to enlarge the British contingent in Iraq?
Well, there are no reports, but we're reading between the lines, and we're pretty sure after the horrific bombings in Basra today that the British government will, in the next few days, reinforce the Basra area, because there quite plainly are nowhere near enough troops in the Basra area to ensure ongoing security.
Major Heyman, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Major Charles Heyman is senior analyst for the Jaynes Consultancy Group in Britain.
Just ahead, why politicians should look to the center of the political spectrum.
And later, if terrorists struck Congress, is there a plan for swiftly replacing our elected representatives?
There's more coming up, here and now.
I'm Michael Goldfarb.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Die-hard registered Republicans and Democrats wear their party on their sleeves, but an increasing number of voters keep their affiliation closer to the vest. According to the National Election Studies, the number of self-described independents almost doubled between 1950 and 2000. John Avlon has written a new book called Independent Nation: How the Vital Center is Changing American Politics. John Avlon served as chief speechwriter for former New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani. He also worked on Bill Clinton's 1996 presidential campaign, and he joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Great pleasure to be here.
You write in your book that centrism is the rising political tide in modern American life. But the name of your book is Independent Nation. What's the difference between a centrist and an independent voter?
Sure. Well, it's interesting. If you look at the numbers, right now there are more independents than Democrats or Republicans in America. And voters, 50% of them are self-described moderates compared to just 30% who are conservatives and 20% who are liberals. All independents are not centrist, but the vast majority of independents or centrists. As politics has grown more and more polarized, people are turned off from that. They're moving away from the two parties because they resent being asked to choose from the lesser of two evils.
But there's polarization within the independent voters.
Much less than you might think. When a Ralph Nader runs as an independent in this election cycle, he's really using the label almost as a Trojan horse. What he is a far-left protest candidacy. And indeed, we've seen Pat Buchanan do the same thing in the past. But the far better indicator of where the independent voters are and just how centrist they are is looking at the third-party candidacies, especially in the last 10 years, the independent governors of the 1990s, Lowell Weicker of Connecticut, Angus King of Maine, Jesse Ventura of Minnesota. All three of them ran very specifically as centrist independents, fiscally conservative but socially liberal.
And that tends to be... Is that the definition?
Increasingly it is. Too fiscally conservative for the Democrats but too socially liberal for the Republicans. This is in sharp contrast to the past when the third-party candidates used to be from the far left or the far right. Henry Wallace in 1948 against Harry Truman, who ran a Soviet-sympathizing campaign in the Progressive Party, or George Wallace in 1972 with the American Independence Campaigns, a segregationist candidate. Both felt that the two parties at that time were too moderate to include their views. Now we're having the exact opposite problem.
Well, in fact, let's do a little bit of history because your book does talk about different kinds of centrists who have bucked the system, overcome the odds. Just give us a couple stories.
I begin the book with Teddy Roosevelt exactly 100 years ago in 1904 when he was running for re-election. He was a reform Republican, and he was looking around the world and realized that socialist revolutions were springing up. And he was concerned that the excesses of capitalism could cause similar divisions within America. So he felt the best way to avoid that was to moderate the excesses of capitalism. But the Wall Street big business crowd that thought they were the base of the Republican Party at the time took great offense at this and tried to knock him out of office. He stood his ground. He reached out to reform Republicans, progressive Democrats, and independents. And as a result, won an unprecedented landslide in 1904. But even better examples that I think provoke a more emotional response, instinctive response, are things like Harry Truman, who campaigned in 48 against Henry Wallace on the left in his own party, and Strom Thurmond on the right, JFK, who was a strong anti-communist, believed in American leadership in the world, wasn't nervous about that at all, but a domestic policy New Dealer.
And, of course, Bill Clinton, the best known of the most recent centrist politicians.
Absolutely. Before Bill Clinton, the Democratic Party had lost three presidential elections in a row with more than 40 states. Now, that's a party on the edge of irrelevance. And the answer is not to go further to the left. Bill Clinton quite consciously reached out and tried to reclaim the allegiance of the middle class and the moderate majority in this country. And as a result, he became the first president since FDR to be reelected.
But as you know, so as there are people who say, and I'm sure you're well aware, Kenneth Bear, for instance, writing a review of your book in the Washington Post, says that, well, a candidate can be centrist and capture the center of the political spectrum, as Bill Clinton did, as ideology. But many have mistakenly viewed centrism now as a tactic, not really something they believe.
That's a very beltway attitude, the cynical approach to politics that says centrism has to be a strategy. In fact, I argue, and American history shows, that centrism is, in fact, a principled political form of governing. Bill Clinton's political strategist, Dick Moore, has presented triangulation as a campaign strategy. But many people cynically write that off and don't fully appreciate or understand the roots of centrism in American politics and the very principled approach to governing it offers.
I guess I'm saying that there are critics who say that this isn't about an ideology. This isn't about people believing something and being in the center. This is about a lot of, again, independent voters and politicians cynically going after them, saying whatever it is they want to hear.
In fact, I'd argue, and American history shows, it's quite the opposite. The vital center, people respond to it. They want an honest broker who isn't blinded by extreme adherence to one ideology or the other, one party or the other. Right now, politics are more polarized than ever before. People are reluctant to walk into the center because they get attacked from both sides. It can be a lonely process, but it's deeply principled. It's that way of moving forward as opposed to moving right or left. Nixon in China is a great example. Only a man with lifelong anti-communist credentials like Richard Nixon could successfully open up relations with communist China. If a liberal like George McGovern had tried that, he would have been called up for impeachment by the Republicans in Congress. Likewise, Clinton and welfare reform. If Ronald Reagan had tried to impose welfare reform, there would have been great troubles in many of our cities. But instead, when a member of the opposite party seizes that opportunity, it feels more like a national consensus has been reached. And that's what we need to return to lower the tone of debate and to turn off these screamers on either side who are alienating so many people in politics today.
Oh, John Avlon, there are people listening saying, oh, you poor dear. The chances of toning down the debate in this presidential election year are slim to none.
That's why the moderate majority in this country needs to start standing up. All the evidence suggests that independents and increasingly disaffected moderates who have rejected both parties because of the extreme poisonous polarization that's gone on. We're seeing independent and centrist websites spring up from around the country, centrist.org, centristcoalition.com. Centrism got oxygenated a bit during the early 1990s. President Bush campaigned as a centrist, as a compassionate conservative. He's largely governed solely as a conservative, though. Centrism has been pushed underground. So that's why the centrist movement is bubbling up from the grassroots right now. But there's real power to it because there's integrity to it, and there's also a history.
Well, John Avlon, thank you very much.
Thank you.
John Avlon, author of the book Independent Nation, How the Vital Center is Changing American Politics.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, should the U.S. resume the military draft?
And what a piece of work is. William Shakespeare will mark his 440th birthday. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Robin Young.
I'm Michael Goldfarb.
It's Here and Now.
He has spoken. Alan Greenspan has delivered his remarks on Capitol Hill to the Joint Economic Committee of the Senate. Yesterday, Greenspan's comments that the banking system is prepared to deal with a rise in interest rates made the markets tremble and fall. Today, he said rates must rise at some point, but went on to add that we are not yet in an environment where that might be the case. What should we be reading into his remarks today? Well, joining us on the line is Ken Goldstein, an economist with the Conference Board, a nonprofit business organization. Welcome.
Hello.
Now, what are your first impressions of what the Federal Reserve Chairman has been saying today?
It's not at all surprising that he again is raising the specter that at some point the Federal Reserve will be moving rates up, but also very careful not to specify at what point they'll be willing to do that. Of course, the market was looking before for some time, maybe in the fall. Now there's some speculation that it could happen as early as the summer. And, of course, Greenspan is not going to fall into the trap of being trapped into what they mean, you know, exactly when they'll do that.
I think that the other question, aside from interest rates, that people are always interested in hearing about is the employment situation. The prepared remarks Alan Greenspan delivered were fairly upbeat at the start, and then he notes that the pace of hiring should pick up on a more sustained basis, bringing with it larger persistent increases in net employment than those prevailing until recently. But then a little later on in his prepared remarks, he went on to say, the anxiety that many in our workforce feel will not subside quickly. Which of those two comments should we really be paying attention to?
Both, actually. And in fact, there's even one more beyond that. When he was talking yesterday about the banking system and that it's you know, has the cash to lend, but that lending has been more for consumers borrowing for mortgages than business borrowing to invest. And he was sort of hinting at a caution that remains on the part of business with respect not just to borrowing but with investment. And I think that you should read into that, that there continues to be some caution on the part of business even with respect to hiring, and therefore hiring might be a little bit less than the economy would otherwise demand. That's number one. And number two, the anxiety is not just about jobs, but also about incomes. He's also saying that precisely because wage costs are not going up is why we're not worried that much about inflation. But the other side of that coin is inflation isn't going up because wages aren't going up, and therefore you still got consumers who are worried about, not just about jobs, less worried about jobs perhaps, maybe more worried about incomes now.
We always talk about Alan Greenspan when he speaks because parsing through it is such an interesting experience. What he says today, does it really have any great effect on how we will interact with the economy, either in our ability to spend or earn?
You know, if you look at what happened yesterday, he said so little, and yet the market reacted so much. It's precisely to say that maybe people are putting too much emphasis on what he's saying. He's not really making any dramatic statements. And so I think that in terms of overall job growth, in terms of overall income growth, certainly in terms of what it's going to cost to borrow for a car or for a mortgage 3 months from now, 6 months from now, it's not going to be that dramatically different. It could be a little bit higher, but probably not dramatically so, and not enough, in a sense, by itself, to really change the direction of the economy.
Ken Goldstein, thank you very much.
Anytime.
Economist Ken Goldstein is with the Conference Board, a nonprofit business research group in New York City.
Two and a half years after the September 11th terrorist attacks, lawmakers in Washington still can't agree on how to make sure Congress can continue its work if more than 100 members are killed or incapacitated in another attack. The House votes on one measure today. It would speed up special elections to within 45 days of a catastrophe. But even that bill's author, Congressman Jim Sensenbrenner, says that his bill leaves a gaping hole in government. Joining us on the line is the sponsor of another bill, Washington State Congressman Brian Baird, a Democrat. Congressman, welcome.
Glad to be with you.
Before we get to your suggestion, why is this process taking so long?
Well, it's really beyond me. You know, we have watched for the last couple of weeks as the September 11th Commission has revealed that there was evidence and warnings preceding September 11th, yet 2.5 years after we know terrorists tried to attack the Capitol, the House hasn't taken action, and I believe that's deeply regrettable.
Well, the question of continuity is more complicated in the House because, let's remind ourselves, the Constitution specifies senators can be replaced by state officials, but representatives have to be elected. It's representative government. Special elections can take 4 months or longer. Today's measure would speed that up. But we understand that the sticking point is that there's a constitutional requirement that a certain number of representatives, a quorum, meet to conduct House business?
Exactly. The Constitution's very clear about this. It says half of the membership has to be present to conduct business. That was designed to ensure that there is representation from all the states. Indeed, the first official act of the first official Congress was to adjourn for lack of a quorum. So the problem arises, what if terrorists attack us? How does our constitutional government function? Do we just give all of the congressional powers, including declarations of war, appropriations of money, etc., to the president? And we should be aware, by the way, the president and vice president could easily be killed in the same attack. So presumably an unelected cabinet official or someone else would take charge of the entire country with no checks and balances, no separation of powers, and no representation from most congressional districts at the worst time in the nation's history.
Well, but as you're well aware, there are many of your colleagues who resist changing this constitutional requirement. A continuity of government commission recommends a constitutional amendment. And do you as well?
I certainly do. What I've proposed is a very succinct and simple amendment which preserves the right to elect permanent replacements to the House of Representatives. And I want to underscore that. It protects your right to elect permanent replacements. But what it does in the interim is allow your presently elected member to create a list of nominees so that the governor of the state could choose from that list in the event of catastrophic losses and the death or incapacity of the sitting member. There would be no partisanship, and you'd have a temporary appointment, and the people could get their house back in functioning, and we'd have a constitutional government within days of a crisis.
But do you understand the resistance to amending the Constitution? I mean, there are some who feel, first of all, that it would be abused. Let's say a representative died, and instead of there being an election, one of his buddies might be picked from his list.
No, there's not, because the amendment that I've put forward only applies in catastrophic circumstances. Mm. Well, let me add to that, too. The Sensenbrenner bill basically eliminates the rights of voters to choose who the candidates will be in the election. It requires that the major political parties select the nominees to run for office, thereby disenfranchising independent voters, thereby restricting a host of people who would otherwise seek to run for office. And my concern is, we know the threat is there. We know the chaos that would ensue. We know the dubious constitutional nature of the measures that have been proposed, lacking the kind of procedures we're putting in place, and yet we've failed to do our responsibility to ensure the continuity of the House, and that's lamentable, to say the least.
Well, Congressman Baird will be following the vote today. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Brian Baird represents the 3rd Congressional District of Washington State.
Still to come, the French techno duo Air, mood music, or much, much more.
You're listening to Here and Now.
John Kerry is releasing more of his military service records. The presumptive Democratic presidential candidate and decorated veteran received the Bronze Star, the Silver Star, and 3 Purple Hearts during the Vietnam War. But his Republican opponents have been pressing him to provide details of his military and medical records, especially those concerning his battlefield injuries, for which he received the Purple Hearts. Jim Drinkard, USA Today political correspondent, has been looking through some just-released Kerry documents. What have you seen? What have you found today? And does it shed light on the question of that first Purple Heart, which seems to be generating a bit of controversy?
There is a little bit of controversy about it, and the controversy is not completely answered by the documents that have been released. One problem seems to be that the documents that you might expect to be in the record for that first Purple Heart are not there. So the campaign is offering some other paperwork which sort of establishes that he did see a medic for a wound, and then there are other documents that establish that the Purple Heart was awarded. But the documentation for that first one is not the same as they have for the other two.
Now, why is this question coming up now?
Well, there have been questions raised in the news media and among political opponents of Kerry as to sort of the nature and extent of his injuries. It comes up because at the time he was in Vietnam, there was a rule in effect that said if you're wounded for the third time, you have the right to be transferred out of the country. And Kerry was transferred after a little over 4 months during his second tour of duty because of that rule. So there are some who charge that it's coincidental to be wounded in a relatively superficial or minor way 3 times in such a short period of time and therefore be eligible for transfer.
But, I mean, during the time that he was awaiting transfer, the man won a Bronze Star and a Silver Star, and his political opponents aren't doubting the bravery shown to receive those medals, are
they? No, I think those are more unassailable, and certainly the Silver Star is the 3rd highest honor that the Navy could confer upon a combatant.
So why then is this becoming such an issue?
Well, you know, there's certainly a strong political element to it. If you'll recall, President Bush went through a pretty intense grilling earlier this year about his own military records. Bush, at the time that Kerry was in Vietnam, was serving in the Texas Air National Guard, and questions were raised about whether he fulfilled his full service obligation.
We remember the story, and we remember the details of it, but it does seem that, on the one hand, I mean, the president, because he was in the Air National Guard as opposed to actually being in the theater of operations that John Kerry was, possibly should have had his record looked at slightly more thoroughly. But there are other things involved here. I understand that they're also releasing some evaluations of John Kerry by his superiors.
Yes, that material is all in the process of being put on Kerry's website, and I have not looked at all of that yet, but there are some evaluations which praise his service call him a, you know, very dedicated and capable and conscientious. And so far, those haven't produced anything that would call his service into question in any way.
Jim Drinkard, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Jim Drinkard is a political correspondent for USA Today. He spoke to us on the phone from Washington.
Stay with us. There's more.
I'm Michael Goldfarb.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
According to one reviewer, the music of the French duo Air is the perfect soundtrack for two people having an interplanetary romance. Air blends electronic and acoustic music to create a unique spacey sound, and Jean-Benoît Dunkel and Nicolas Godin are not strangers to soundtracks. They supplied the music for two Sofia Coppola films. The latest, a song called Alone in Kyoto, was featured in Lost in Translation. On their new CD, Talkie Walkie, they've returned to Earth with a warmer, more personal sound. Here and Now producer Lindsay Crudell sat down with Air before a recent concert.
Hello, I am Nicolas.
Hello, I am Jean-Benoît.
And you're here in Boston. You're going to be playing some songs from your latest CD, Talkie Walkie, and I wanted to ask you, talkie-walkie sounds a lot like the English phrase walkie-talkie. Explain to me how that works.
Because in France, we are the only country in the world where we say talkie-walkie instead. We write some songs and we make a lot of English mistakes, and that's part of our charm.
I read that you said you enjoy writing in English, even though your native language is French, because you can get away with saying things and your friends don't understand back at home.
I think that English is a solution for us to hide. When you hide yourself with a language, you can say the truth. But if you use your original language, you tend to not say the truth.
Could I have an example, or would I be finding out a secret?
It's really hard to say in French, je t'aime, because je t'aime is like, it's too violent. But I love you is more soft. With English, we can say some things that we didn't dare to say in French.
So, talkie-walkie is not an ironic phrase, but it seems like your music skirts the boundaries of a very unhip sound and yet comes out sounding incredibly hip. Is it irony that allows you to do that? What is that that allows you to do that?
I think we were very ironic until the last album. And for Talkie Walkie, we were tired of being ironic. And we decided to be true and to say things of first degree. And we wanted to get back to something more human, with putting our face on the cover and singing ourselves the songs and telling simple things.
Now let's talk about some of the songs on your latest album. We've been talking about a more personal, warm, human sense. And let's talk about, for example, the very intimate lyrics of Biological. Your reaction to the fame that you found after the tremendous success of your first full-length album, Moon Safari?
It was scary because it was our first album, so we were not used to that. And in France, not anymore, but we were pretty outsiders. And it takes us a lot of energy when we go in a studio to forget all these things and not to think about what people expect from us. Each time you make a record, you don't have to think it must be successful or you shouldn't be scared to lose your fame. That's a lot of artists we know are scared to reach of, and it's harder and harder the more you get famous. And then you're just scared to lose your status. And so Gigi and me, we try to stay outsiders. So we have nothing to lose when we make an album. And this is good like that. It's better for creativity.
One of your fans is the director Sofia Coppola. You scored her film The Virgin Suicides. And your music has turned up again in Lost in Translation. What was your reaction seeing your music applied to the context of the film?
Each time I see our music, I say to myself that the pictures are doing the work, and that music for soundtracks is just a catalyst for the emotion. And when you understand that, when you understand that the pictures are more important, you are able to do some good soundtracks. Because, music has the power to, you know, to see a certain angle of the movie. And I like what we have done because it was poetic. And Nicolas and me, we lived the same situation because we, like the actress in the movie, we went in Kyoto and we have visited these temples. And so we had this feeling about, you know, hanging around and, you know, being lost in Kyoto.
How do you think American audiences absorb French culture and French music?
It's pretty good here for us because, as you said, it's about French culture. And as soon as we don't try to sound like an American band, like a rock band, people will like it. I think people will not like it, stop liking us if we try to imitate you. And the fact that we sound very French, that's what people like here. I feel more interest for other culture in music here than in France, for example, where the music is only sold in supermarkets and stuff like that. Behind this huge commercial network, there is a lot of underground and outsiders networks that works very well for another kind of music.
I read that your producer, Nigel Godrich, instructed you to not speak during the production of your album. Is this true?
No, it's not true.
Okay.
No, because we there was something in the bio saying that we were using talkie-walkies. Telepathic communication, that in the studio we don't need to speak because we know each other very well. And that's why that sometimes we don't have to speak to each other because, it's not useful to produce or to play or to record. Really, really speak a lot during in the studio with Nigel, maybe too much sometimes.
Yeah.
Conversation with two members of the French band Air, Jean-Benoît Dunkel and Nicolas Gaudin, was produced by Lindsay Crudel.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Michael Goldfarb.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.